You're listening to One in a series of presentations from the 2008 High Ed Web Conference in Springfield, Missouri.
Thank you, Doug. I'm going to use microphones. I hope all of you can hear me. But first of all, I just want to thank you for choosing this session. What I'm going to do in my presentation is address one of the questions that came at the end of the first session on this track yesterday. And basically that question was, how do you get the baby boomer administrators, the folks on our camps that are leaders, to kind of let go of the old way of doing things, understand that there's a new world out there, a new generation of students coming in. I say that I'm going to address that issue. I don't know if I'm going to answer it, but what I'll do here in the next 45 minutes is kind of tell you our story a little bit, some of the things that I've been involved in trying to be somewhat of a change leader, at least an influencer, to get my campus, the University of Montana, to move forward a little bit. I will start just a little bit of information. As I mentioned, I'm from the University of Montana. We're in Missoula, an institution that, actually I was looking at the Missouri State website yesterday and looking for a little bit of information about the size and the demographics here, and saw a page that mentioned peer institutions, and I clicked on the link, and one of 11 schools mentioned as a peer institution in Missouri State is the University of Montana. So in a lot of ways, very similar to the institution here. I'd say we do some things very well. We've grown rapidly. Doug mentioned I've been associated with the university for a long time. When I was a student there in the early to mid-80s, there were fewer than 9,000 students. We're over 14,000 now, and there were probably 7 or 8 new buildings on campus that we were when I was a student. I'm going to talk just a little bit about my experience, just to give you some background. I don't want this to be about me, but to give you a little bit of an idea of some of the things I've been involved with at the university. I spent the first, actually I graduated from the University of Montana in 1986, and as Doug mentioned, I spent a lot of time working in admissions. I've actually been really surprised at how many people I've encountered at this conference who are in web jobs or in IT jobs that started out in admissions. And so out of college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I loved being on a college campus. I really liked my university, so it was an opportunity to do some marketing, work on strategies. I did all of our publications and those kinds of things. And obviously when the web came along, that was something that I had to add to my repertoire. I think we recognized right away that this was going to change the way that we recruited, the way that we communicated with prospective students. My first real web job came in 1999-ish, 98-99, when our Division of Student Affairs created a position to coordinate all the web strategy and activities for about 11 departments. And then I was only in that for about a year when we had a new CIO that I'd worked with a little bit during that time, offered me a position in IT. So over the last 8 years in our IT organization, I've done a number of things from managing a digital media group, I've managed an application development group, as our IT web leader for about a year, and currently I'm our director of IT communication, which I can talk about a little bit later on. For me, mid-90s was a huge turning point in my career. As I mentioned, when I came out of college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life even at that point. But the web is something that I think had obviously changed everyone's lives, and probably all of us here changed our careers pretty dramatically. I knew there was going to be a need for some leadership with the things that were coming. That kind of motivated me to go back to school, work on a public administration degree. One of the things that I really focused on during that time when I was back in school is organizational theories, organizational behavior, trying to understand how big organizations like a university works and how decisions get made, how behaviors come about. One of the real valuable experiences that I had came shortly after I got done with my master's degree, and that was getting involved with some of the governance on campus, and it's something I would recommend if you're not real involved. I spent a couple of years as the president of our staff senate. I gave me an opportunity to kind of rub elbows with presidents and vice presidents and deans and regents and legislators, and also get an understanding of how decisions got made, how the politics of campus worked. And probably the best experience I've had in IT in terms of learning and kind of character building was leading an enterprise portal project over about a 4-year period. And have any of you been involved in portal implementations? For those of you, I assume you can probably relate to this, they're incredibly difficult. I think the first technology conference I ever went to was a portal technology conference in about 1999. And at that point, I was just getting into IT. I was way above my head with the technology part of it. But I went to one of the first sessions I went to, the speaker was talking about portals, and he said, the technology part is the easy part. The hard part is going to be changing our institutions. It's going to be changing our policies and our processes. It's going to be changing the culture. It's going to be changing our concepts of data ownership and all those kind of things. So I think it was at that point that I knew that, okay, maybe there's a place for me in the technology world, someone who maybe isn't a technical person, but can kind of bridge that gap between the technology and what our institutions need to do to take advantage of that. So that's it for me. I'm going to talk a little bit. I wish I could find who said it. I read this quote or heard it somewhere a few years ago. And a lot of the things I'll talk about today, some of the things I've tried and I've been involved with have worked very well. I'll try to be very honest when I'm talking about things that I tried that didn't work well and some of the surprises. There were a lot of surprises in the portal project implementation that I worked on. And typically in a big project like that, you don't want surprises. So the advantage of it is that in the end, I think I gained some experience that I can hopefully pass along here. In my description of this presentation, and when I was writing this description and developing the presentation idea back in the spring, I referred to the Clue Trade Manifesto, and that was also mentioned in our opening session yesterday. How many of you have read this book? Not too many. This is a book that I read in about 2000, when it came out in 1999, and basically the premise was is that everything was going to change in the business world, and also I think that would relate to higher education, in that this new technology was allowing conversations in a way that had never been possible before. That it really was going to shift the power and the control. I think it resonated with me. It was very radical at the time, and it resonated with me, I think, in large part because having been associated with the university for some time, I could see the frustrations that a lot of students dealt with, not so much from the education side, but more from the bureaucratic side of getting registered, paying fees, getting financial aid, getting academic advising, those types of things. And so I was interested in this as a kind of a vision for how things were going to change down the road because of this new technology that was coming along. And I think what's remarkable about it is how accurate their vision of what was going to happen is. And that really has come about, I think. So what I'm going to do today is, as I try to talk about some of the things that we can do as institutions, as web people, as marketing people, as folks who are in some management leadership positions, what we can do to influence change on our campus, lead change on our campus. And talk about these four areas. Stephen Covey, read him a while back, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. One of his habits that he talks about is seek first to understand and then be understood. So I think the first thing that's important is that for all of us, we need to really understand what's going on with the technology. And I think this group, obviously, being in a conference like this and being involved in it, you are going to understand what are the most on our campuses, kind of the impact of the web environment right now. Attitude is, I'm going to just talk about a little bit. I think anytime you're trying to change behavior, attitude is a critical part of that. I had a real fear when I was moving from a admissions area into more of a technical field that, you know, I certainly wasn't prepared for that. I didn't have the technical background that I needed. And I think what I was afraid of more than anything, and what I think most people are afraid of, is looking foolish. And I had this perception that the people who were the technical people were a lot smarter than me. They knew a lot more than me. And that was hard to deal with. And I think at one point I just had to kind of accept the fact that I'm going to look stupid. It's okay. I'll just go along with it. I'll play along and I'll learn a lot. And I did. I think what I learned more than anything, though, is that the people who look like they know a lot, they do know a lot in certain areas, but they also have gaps in their knowledge and gaps in their skills that someone with communications background or marketing background or management background can fill in for them. So there is, and I'll go into this a little bit more, some of the attitude issues that I think us personally as an individual have to address and then try to influence others. Opportunity is really, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that I've done to then actually try to influence change. Not going to go into all of the things that could possibly be done, but just some things that we've tried that have worked or haven't worked. And delivery, once you do have the opportunity to communicate, to influence, to try to persuade people on your campus, I'll just talk about some things that I think can help you do that much better. So understand, you know, our last speaker, Kyle, mentioned Seth very early on. I try to start every day at work by opening up our campus portal where I have a whole bunch of RSS feeds coming in. And the first one I read every day is Seth Godin's blog. And so one of the things I'm going to do is, and you talk about some of the books that I've read, some influential thought leaders that I follow. And I think Seth is one that we absolutely have to look at in terms of understanding the current environment and where we're headed. So just about a week ago, actually, I read his blog, and this comment was in there. It's easy to be against something you're afraid of, and it's easy to be afraid of something that you don't understand. And so I guess if I turn that around and went from the bottom up, you know, if we understand something, we're not going to be as afraid of it. And if we're not afraid of it, we're going to be more likely to adopt it. Just a couple of weeks ago, I read a profile on Seth in Business Week. And basically, they said he has mastered marketing in the digital age. So some credibility there for hopefully what I'm saying. Yeah, have any of you want to read Seth's book, Meatball Sunday? One person, okay. So if you don't read any other book, I would recommend this, certainly if you're in the marketing area, but really if you're in any kind of a management position at your university or college. So basically the premise of Meatball Sunday is that you can't put new marketing techniques on top of old ways of doing business and have it come out the way you want. And really what he's saying is that the new marketing, what's coming along, requires us to reinvent our entire organization. That's a lot to ask, obviously. And I don't see our universities being totally reinvented, but obviously we need to change to some degree. So he would say that we've done, you know, we are moving forward in terms of understanding marketing and changing the way we market. But in most cases, the base of our organization, how we operate, has not changed. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but in the book it has 14 trends that he talks about. And I think this is really helpful for you to understand, again, the environment and the impact and where our organizations need to adjust in order to take advantage of this. Yes?
Can I interrupt with a question?
Yes.
I always worry about folks because they tend to go out of date very quickly.
Yes.
Do you know what year this
was published? It was within the last year.
Okay.
Yeah, very new. And I also, like I said, I would subscribe to Seth's blog because I mean, he posts once, twice, three times a day, and so he keeps it very up to date. This book I just read this summer, I think it just came out within the last year. It's another one that I would recommend if you're trying to understand marketing and the new world. They use the term groundswell to describe what's happening in kind of the Web 2.0 world. subtitled Winning in a World Transformed by Social Technologies. This is by Charlene Lee, Josh Burnoff from Forrester Research. This is a fairly research-based, they have done a lot of research on, and have provided case studies about how people have implemented new marketing techniques. A little bit about, I guess, how they describe the groundswell as a social trend in which people use technologies to get things they need from each other, rather from traditional institutions like corporations or like higher education institutions. Consequences of this new world are things that we've all talked about and other speakers have talked about. The balance of power has shifted. Control of our marketing messages has really more or less gone away. If you're trying to control your brand, you might as well give up on that because people are taking your brand and doing whatever they want with it. And another thing that really related back to the Clue Trade Manifesto that I found interesting is it's not just our interaction between our institutions and our external customers, our prospective students and alumni and donors and all that, but it's really a change in the relationship between our institutions and our internal employees and how they are communicating with each other, collaborating with each other. And then this is, there is a nice tool in this groundswell that talks about how you can go about developing a strategy for implementing social media in your marketing message. And so when you look at this, you start with people assessing your customer's social activities, and there are some nice data in there that shows you for different types of markets and audiences, what the activity level is. Objective, decide what you want to accomplish. I'm always amazed at how often on our campus, and it probably is true elsewhere, that people jump to the bottom. They jump to the technology part of it and say, we need a Facebook presence, or we need this or that, without really stopping to think about, you know, whether our audience is actually using that technology, what it is we're trying to accomplish with that technology. I think the one takeaway that, from this book that struck me more than any is the strategy part of it, and plan for how relationships with your customers will change. And that really, as I thought about that on my campus anyway, I have always had this vision that the great thing about this new technology is that I look at all these people who are providing customer service and support to our students, and they look miserable because they're sitting there all day long answering the same question over and over and over and doing mundane tasks over and over and over. And I was thinking how great it will be when we are doing all of those mundane and repetitious things online and freeing up that personal contact with advisors or customer support folks to address much more complex questions and problems that students have. What I have found, for the most part, is that, first of all, people feel threatened when you start taking away things they've been doing, and they also don't really want, in a lot of cases, without some leadership from their management, they don't want to take on more complex problems. They don't want students coming in to them with things that they don't know how to handle, and again, that they might look foolish about. So I don't know, certainly on our campus in a lot of cases, we haven't achieved the kind of transformation to much more rich personal contact because we've moved more mundane stuff online. But I do think that that's one area of leadership where, if you're in an office where you can get folks to accept the fact that, hey, this is a great opportunity for us to interact with students on a whole new level. We'll provide you the training and the support and those kind of things. I think that's where we can improve our institutions, improve retention issues, those types of things. And then one more book that I read a couple of years ago that I really enjoyed is Robert Scoble's and Shel Israel's book, Naked Conversations About Blogging. It's interesting to me, as I go around talking about blogging on our campus, there's some perceptions about blogging that are fairly persistent, and I don't know if these are your perceptions about blogging, but one is comment I get is, well, blogging is just personal journaling. Well, why should we ever use that in the university setting? The other perception is, well, blogging is what muckraking journalists use to embarrass people or those kind of things. How do we ever use blogging in higher education? What I try to explain over and over is that, you know, that blogging is a tool, and that's how certain people have used the tool. But just, you know, step back and think about some ways that we could use blogging differently in terms of a content management system, influencing thought on campus. And I'll show you a little bit about how we implemented some blogging on our campus as well. If you don't want to read the whole book, one thing I would recommend is the April 2007 issue of Wired did talk about the book, kind of told the story in particular of how Microsoft kind of had this internal battle of opening up blogging and video blogging to its employees, really changed the perception from the outside world of what Microsoft was, because people had contacts within the organization who were working on development projects. And this, again, issue talks about that transparency and that authenticity that we talked about in the first session yesterday. And then I'm just going to mention three other online possibilities that I think really help in terms of understanding what's going on. I quite often refer to these Common Craft explanations in plain English. Have any of you seen any of these? So basically what they do is, you'll have to watch them. They talk about things like blogging and wikis and RSS feeds and all of these new technologies, but they do it in a way that is incredibly simple and entertaining. And so I quite often speak those into presentations that I do so that people can get a grasp of, you know, what a wiki is without me trying to explain it. The New Media Center issues an annual Horizon report, and it's a nice kind of visionary piece that talks about emerging technologies, and it does it in a way that it will tell you, okay, these technologies are being used right now in higher education. These technologies will likely be used within the next 3 to 5 years. These technologies are further down the road. So it's a nice way to kind of see what the future might be. And then the last one that I would highly recommend is EDUCAUSE has their 7 Things You Should Know About series. And there's a little explanation of what this is. The 7 Things You Should Know About pieces provide quick, no jargon overviews of emerging technologies and related practices that have demonstrated or may demonstrate positive learning impacts. Anytime you need to explain a new learning technology or practice quickly and clearly, look for a 7 Things You Should Know About brief from DLI. And basically what the 7 things they do is they'll take technology, in fact, I think one of the most recent ones is NAME that we just heard about, and it will answer these questions. What is it? Who's doing it? How does it work? Why is it significant? What are the downsides? Where is it going? And what are the implications for teaching and learning? So it's a nice tool. I think it happened back over about a 4-year period that you can refer back to. And so if anybody on your campus asks you, well, what's this new technology all about? And you don't know, this is a quick reference. So I mentioned my fear about moving from a non-technical position to a technical arena. And I guess one of the experiences that I've had is that more than anything, what affects our behaviors and our decisions is this fear, this dread. And I got to thinking as I was working on this presentation back to the early mid-90s, when web was just coming out, in a conversation I had with an older faculty member on our campus. She was terrified of this. And she was terrified because she had spent her whole life preparing for this career, and she could see that things were changing and that this vision of her career that she had was maybe not going to be there in a short amount of time. This is an image that I actually used one in a presentation a while back, mostly to illustrate use of our students' cell phone technologies. And this kind of went along with a story about in Japan last year, the top 10 selling novels all started as cell phone text novels. That's a big thing in Japan. Of course, you tell that to somebody who's my age or older, they just can't fathom that. But I threw this picture in this presentation just because I think it tells the real story about what's going on, and that is the generation gap. And I've seen it particularly when I was working in our portal project. I was managing a group of web application developers who ranged in age from 19 to 27 or 28. We were working with a group of our enterprise systems developers who ranged in age from 35 to 65. And it was just, I think the biggest surprise I had is how those two groups just could not come together. And I probably, as kind of a project leader, did not do a good job of bridging that gap. But just an incredible mistrust between the generations. Younger generation thinking the older folks didn't know what the heck they were doing, and they're old, they're out of date, they're obsolete. The older generation thinking that these young punks were coming in and they were radical and they didn't know what they're doing, they're going to cause all kinds of security issues and those types of things. And I think really one of the most important skills that we can have is somehow bridging that gap between baby boomers and these new young people that are coming in as our students and as our, I think most of our web developers, for example, are going to be coming in having grown up with this technology. So I just threw this in as, this was kind of the vision that I think a lot of people had of my web team, that I was hiring these people that were, young and irresponsible. But I think attitude-wise, one of the things that can help most is to stay young, think young, and more than anything, hang out with young people and not just dismiss their ideas and what they're doing with this new technology. I have a 14-year-old son, and I mean, he's on text messages all day long, and I try to pick his brain and try to think as much as I can like him and understand how his world is different than my world was at 14, or envision how his world is going to be much different when he gets into college and into the work world than mine was. So opportunity. Just going to talk about some of the things that I've been involved in that hopefully have had some positive impact in some change leadership on our campus. Organizing that. Obviously, I think the more people that you can have talking the same way with shared visions and shared ideas, the better. I formed a group after I became our IT communications director a year ago last summer. One of the first things I did is I went out individually to a whole bunch of different people around our campus and just sat down with them and had one-on-one conversations and asked them, what is it about the communication between central IT and your area that doesn't work? What are your concerns? Just try to get to know them a little bit. A few months later, I had an idea that we needed to get, by doing that, I was connecting with people that, for the most part, I already knew, but didn't really understand maybe all their issues and their challenges. So I pulled together a group that started with, one other guy, and I said, would it work to get a group together that just talked about technology issues? And he said, yeah, that'd be great. We started recruiting a few other people. And you can see the list of, obviously you're not going to know any of the names probably, but you can see what kind of jobs and what areas of campus they're from. I've got our Associate Vice President for Enrollment Services. I have our HR Director. I have several people from our faculty. Some technical people. But for the most part, I've tried to have representatives from every sector of campus, academics, research, student affairs, on and on. I have an instructional designer from our online area who happens to be married to our provost. So some strategic decisions about who I invited. This is, I'd say this is kind of an anti-Web 2.0 thing. We don't do anything online. And we're still in kind of a fledgling stage, but sure what happened there. One of the things, the first things we did, we just did a little brainstorming about what was this group could accomplish. And these were some of the ideas that, and it's pretty easy to clump some of these together and see what people felt like needed to be changed about our campus. More cooperation, more openness, more collaboration, partnerships, getting away from the turf wars and duplication of effort and all those kind of things. Really, we call ourselves a think tank. We haven't done a lot of the things a think tank would typically do in terms of writing white papers or making policy proposals. But more than anything, we're all trying to just be on the same page, and we all have our various channels up through deans and directors and vice presidents and whatnot, so that there is some consistent influence, hopefully, about what's going on. So that's one of the things that we've done. I'm a big proponent of strategic planning initiatives that involve a lot of people. Again, it's something that is not widely liked or used on our campus. I don't know what your experience is with that. Again, it kind of goes back to when you do these things, you're giving up some control. And I think in a lot of cases, people on my campus don't like giving up that control and having other people have the opportunity to say what they should be doing. But one of the things I did during the time period that I was our web director is I got one of our vice presidents to support financially doing these campus-wide web strategic planning initiative. And I needed some financial backing because one of the things I wanted to do was hire a professional facilitator to come in. So it wasn't me leading this, it was, and also to have some influence or make a little bit of this coming somewhat from our higher administration. My next step is to go to our campus web committee and get them to be really the sponsor and leader of this. And then again, a surprise came about that there was some real reluctance or resistance about doing this, about having, as you can see, we ended up having about 44 people from all over campus spend 4 hours on one afternoon and 4 hours the next morning in this process. But there were people who were adamant that we shouldn't do this. And, we've done these strategic planning things before and it never worked. We just generated a lot of ideas that we can't follow, that we can't do. And I really struggled to try to explain, well, this is a different process, and what we're trying to do is, we know we have limited resources. What I wanted is some prioritization about what's most important and what we can do with the resources that we have. I ended up having to bring the facilitator in to meet just with our web committee so he could kind of explain the process and what we would get out of this. Basically, we came up with a vision statement. We came up with three very simple goals, two of which really didn't have anything to do with the web, but they had to do with leadership, change management, and with continuing these kind of planning processes. So in the end, the people that participated, I don't know that there was a huge value in changing our web as it is today, but there was a huge value in changing people's relationship with each other across campus and their trust in each other and understanding of what was, that they were part of this process. They were a stakeholder in this, and we actually asked them to listen to what they had to say. One of the things I did is we created a document that has every single idea that was generated during these 2 days, and it's like 8-point type, 3 columns, and it's 11 pages long. And so I shared that just so people could see all of the comments. Another planning thing that we did, this is related to the portal, and this was and I actually had the same facilitator come back and do this. We were stuck with our portal project. We weren't moving forward. We've been working on it a while. So we did a thing called a force field analysis where we got a group together and we brainstormed all the things, all the positive things that were pushing the project forward, and then we stopped and we brainstormed all of the restraining forces, all the things that were holding us back, and then we prioritized those as to which we thought were the most important. And this kind of shows you the results of that. So on the driving force, our ability to have single sign-on door systems is very high. Our ability to have a targeted messaging system where we could effectively communicate with folks was high. On the restraining forces side, there had been a little bit of lack of real marketing and communication about the world. And so those were the three things that we took and ran with, and it shaped our decisions and our behavior and our strategy, but more than anything, a lot of people had a chance to have a say in that, and in the process understand what we were trying to accomplish with the portal. I'm going to move a little quickly. I know we're actually getting a little bit close to the end, but blogging is another opportunity. Blogging is a big investment, but I started some blogging in our central IT organization. I have a community blog where my idea was to try to focus on the distributed IT community and change the culture there and how we communicated with them. I did blogging, again, partly because it's a nice way to have some dynamic content in our IT website, and trying again to change people's behavior in terms of subscribing to content as opposed to us doing everything by listserv and sending everything by email. We've had like our web redesign group use blogging to talk about their projects, so we're starting to move on that. If you get a chance to present anytime, that's another thing that I think is important. This next week, web developer and I are doing a Web 2.0 demystified. I think at this point we have 20-some people that are registered for that, so really good interest in that. A little bit later on, we're doing a more detailed one on blogs and wikis. And then I wanted to talk about an opportunity we had sometime about last winter or spring when our executive council actually sent a request to our web team. They wanted a presentation about social networking. And I've been trying for a very long time to get into this audience and to talk about what was going on. And finally it came from them that, okay, we want to know about social networking. We ended up reworking the, kind of ignoring what they asked for specifically, and thinking that what we wanted to do was much more of a high-level talk about Web 2.0. So what's going to do is run through some of the slides and some of the strategy we use to communicate to our executive officers, president, vice presidents, a few others who serve on that. So this was our opening screen. We're going to talk about Web 2.0 and we talked about the attributes that it's really about user-generated content, sharing, collaboration, and really is the web is a computing platform. And then the applications, I'll kind of show you how we addressed each of those. One of the things that I felt like we needed to do, though, before we started was to be able to relate this new world to something that they can understand, and that's kind of the role of a metaphor. So I wasn't smart enough to come up with a metaphor on my own, so I got on Google and I Googled Web 2.0 metaphor, and I apologize that I didn't even make note of who suggested this, but the metaphor was that Web 2.0 was like living in the suburbs, and Web 2.0 was like living in the city. So we did this slide, and what's it like to live in the suburbs? Quiet, solitary, private, disconnected, controlled, homogenous, safe. And then Web 2.0, dynamic, diverse, a little bit dangerous, serendipitous, authentic, multicultural, there's public spaces, there's unique local character and characters. So we started with this, this metaphor for how life had changed and talked about how you can see why our students, people in the 18, 22, 25 range like being in this area. And we got done with that, and then there was, it was real quiet for a little bit, and I thought, oh, that didn't go very well. And then one of our associate provosts said, I like living in the suburbs. And all of a sudden, it kind of opened up the conversation that, and then the people did start to admit their fear. They did admit that they were, they didn't like being in this area because it was dangerous. And, And they didn't like it, certainly as an institution being in this area. So it was a great tool, and I share it here because definitely use this if you're talking to folks who don't really understand how things are shifted. So quickly what we did in our presentations, we just kind of ran through a high-level overview of a lot of these tools. And for the most part, we wanted to show them what was going on in these tools related to the University of Montana so that they understood that, without us doing anything, there was a whole bunch of stuff out there that our users were generating, 300 and some videos about the University of Montana on YouTube, 1,300 photos at that time about the tag University of Montana on Flickr. We showed a little bit about how these worked in terms of the tagging and commenting and some conversation that was going on about the University of Montana. I think one other thing that really helped relieve their fears a little bit is as we showed them a lot of these things, they saw that most of the conversation and most of the comments were very positive. And, they weren't, I think that was a good sign that, even for me, having had this concern about what could happen when you don't have control over your message, I think it's a good sign that we're doing good things, we have a good environment, we have good education, that when you look at it out in the world, the Web 2.0, most of this conversation is very positive. We ran through MySpace, Facebook, LinkedIn. We showed them the admissions office has their own MySpace site.
Did you check all the comments before you presented this?
For the most part, we did pretty much static stuff here. But I certainly didn't try to hide anything. And I think that was one of the messages we tried to get across is that, there may be negative stuff out there. But one of the reasons you need to understand this and maybe participate in this world is that you can't address those negative issues in the same environment that they come up. And also that it's nice to show that, okay, one person maybe complained about parking, that's generally a negative or a fairly minor issue. But when negative comments come up, typically people come back and support you. And you don't have to be the one. Like our speaker yesterday said, it's more authentic when it's coming from your own students as opposed to your PR department. We really pushed Facebook at that time. This was about the time that Facebook had announced that they were opening up their APIs. We shared a little bit of research about the very fast growth of Facebook among 12 to 17-year-olds, which obviously is our incoming classes for the next few years. We tried to get across to them the idea our campus has discovered email farming. Oh, this is a great tool. We can communicate to everyone all at once. Everything can go to everyone. And so we talked about this concept that our students really don't use email all that much other than just to read what you send them when they absolutely have to. And talked about the concept of messaging as opposed to email. And messaging not just in text messaging, but in all of these various applications that and the whole change in the concept of how folks communicate with each other. Talked about wikis, again, by showing the University of Montana Wikipedia entry and showing the revision history, who's been involved in writing that. And then we showed them how one of our graduate programs was using the wiki that we host to do some collaboration online. We showed them a little bit about Second Life, talked about Delicious and social tagging, talked about syndication of content and RSS feeds, on and on. We talked about mashups, and this is something that when I proposed it to our CIO, we talked about, I thought he would mix this, but he actually really liked the idea of talking about this. This is an example, what we use as an example is something we developed in our portal. Where we have an off-campus housing channel. We aggregate rental units from various property management and real estate companies, mash that together with Google Maps, very cool tool, and some of the other things we're doing. So it was nice to show them that and show them what we were capable of doing in-house with existing data that really added a lot of value to our students in terms of their student service retention issues and those types of things. And then just quickly, delivery, a couple more books I'm going to recommend. Made to Stick is, again, a very new book. I think I just read it within the last year. If your job is to communicate, I highly recommend this. Basically talks about the messages having, sticky messages having six attributes: simplicity, unexpectedness, concreteness, credibility, emotions, and stories. And this is a book that I've read actually a couple of times. I've made notes and stick it up on my wall so I can refer to it. I won't go into a lot of detail, but the six attributes kind of spell success, so it's easy to remember that. And a lot of times when I'm trying to craft some communication, I refer back to these and try to take advantage of some of the strategies that it suggests. And then the other one that I would suggest is, again, a fairly new book called The Back of the Napkin. And this is talking about drawing as a way to not only communicate, but also just come up with ideas. One of my primary duties is helping our CIO create communications that he then takes to his weekly executive officers meetings. And almost never do any of the requests come to him that don't start with the words, "I need a picture. I need a picture that shows our network infrastructure. I need a picture that depicts our identity creation process. I need a picture that is our emergency communication system." And so he's really embraced this idea of being able to take a picture, show it to folks. Jeffrey Dean yesterday talked about a lot of this visualization stuff, and that, you know, if somebody feels dumb, it's not the fault of the person who is receiving the communication, it's the fault of the person that's giving it. And so we've really tried to embrace making things, again, as simple as possible, understandable for folks who don't have a technical background. And, you know, making them feel okay so that they can be part of the decision because they understand what's going on and they're not, you know, using fear against them, that type of thing. So that's it. How they do. We have time for any questions?
For you. If you want to do maybe one or two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any questions or comments, or does anybody have any experiences or ideas they'd like to share?
Question. I like the analogy about the city and the suburbs. So I'm thinking, okay, what's the next generation? Does the suburbs become more citified as people get older, and then there's something more scarier to come?
I haven't thought that far ahead.
It would be back to the campfire.
Back to the campfire, yeah. It'll always be something. I think that's one thing, too, that we have to, you know, kind of go back to the attitude. I think we just have to accept that things are going to change so fast that, you know, whatever it is today, we can't be comfortable with it. And so, I don't know that I have the answer to what the next day is, but yeah, we know it'll change.
Thanks, Gordon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more presentations from the 2008 Higher Ed Web Conference, visit highedweb.org/2008 or sign up for our podcasting feed at highedweb.org/podcast.xml.